Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Thank you again to Rula for sponsoring this episode.
What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
Haley Gray is a credentialed victim advocate and podcast researcher, writer, and producer, whose extensive career in podcasting has seen many phases. Over the last 9 years, she has lent her skills to numerous well-known true crime podcasts with an ever-growing intent to make the true crime podcasting space a more ethical and equitable one. In this very candid conversation, Haley shares about her own journey, her growing awareness, as well as innumerable tips and takeaways for victims and those seeking to make a difference for victims. The Broken Cycle Media team is incredibly appreciative of Haley's work, mission, and all that she does to support the victim community.
I'm Haley Gray. I am a credentialed victim advocate, as well as a podcast researcher, writer, and producer. Today, I work for multiple podcasts. I also work directly with families who have missing or murdered loved ones. I help them get coverage, whether through podcasts or regular media, and then I help them come up with advocacy plans to help with their case. I have a training program where I teach people how to research. I also have a program for families so that they can learn how to advocate for their loved one's case as well. I've been working in this field for 9 years now. I started with my own podcast way back in the day before podcasting was even really popular. If my family had to describe me, they would describe me as helpful, caring, maybe a little sensitive, and also funny. I have an interesting relationship with my father. He has now passed away, but he was very funny and did a lot of really interesting and hilarious things. He was in this parody group that was headed by a math professor where they made songs about math. They would do them every year for Pi Day. One of them kind of went viral and they ended up winning tickets to see Weird Al. So I grew up loving math too, but he was also not a good person and he did a lot of really horrible things. He would kill our pets to punish us. He was very mentally abusive to my mom. He was very controlling. She didn't have friends. If she went on a trip and he didn't want her to, then she would come back and her dog would be dead. He moved us to the country so that he could isolate us, and he had really strict rules. I grew up in this very weird atmosphere. But on the other hand, I was my dad's favorite, and so he didn't abuse me as much as he abused my mom and my sister. I know that I have some issues with people-pleasing from my childhood. My therapist says that to people-please became one of my literal needs to survive, along with water and food, because I saw what my dad would do to my sister and my mom. He would tell me things like, you're very smart, you can do anything you want to do. I never really knew what I wanted to do with my life. I distinctly remember watching Legally Blonde and thinking, I want to be a lawyer. Anything strong, female-led, I was like, I want to do that. My dad owned a business, and people from around the country and sometimes around the world would come in, and they would have such interesting jobs. One of his closest friends was a chemistry professor at a university in Wisconsin. He was also a pilot, and I just thought that was so cool. My adopted grandma was an English professor and also a music teacher. And so I just grew up with people who had interesting jobs around me. And I always thought, when I'm older, I want to be an expert in my field and I want to make a difference in this world. But I never really knew what that looked like. My whole life, I've been the type of person to strike up a conversation everywhere I go. My mom said that I started talking early. She would catch me talking to strangers at the store. Being able to get inside people's minds and understand why they operate the way they do, I have always felt like if we did more of that, the world would be a better place. I kind of grew up really early. I started living on my own when I was 17 and had to work multiple jobs while also going to school. I went to college when I was also in high school. I was taking all kinds of different classes in the evenings at college, just trying to figure out what was interesting to me. And I changed my major so many times. I have 2 associate's degrees. A lot of the times I maybe wanted to do the things that my dad wanted me to do. But then when I became an adult, I was able to break away from that. I took my first college psychology course when I was in high school, and I loved my teacher. He was so interesting. I became his teaching assistant. The way that he taught psychology was fascinating, and he actually has a brother with schizophrenia, and so he was able to talk to us about what that really looked like, not what movies portray. I just loved psychology. And then when I finally figured out my major, that's when I started taking even more psychology classes. My dad was not a fan of psychology. I think that he didn't want people to understand the way that his brain worked. He was actually kind of mad at me when I decided I wanted to be a therapist. At the same time, I was doing a true crime podcast. I am not your typical true crime person. I did not grow up watching Forensic Files or Unsolved Mysteries. I actually didn't even know what those were until I became a podcaster. My dad was very strict, so like I could only watch specific things. We didn't have cable. I didn't grow up knowing about these things. So I think I was just fascinated by the research aspects. I just love digging in and learning things. And I think that's why a lot of people are interested in true crime, because they do want to get inside the minds of people who do these horrible things. We all want to understand why people are the way that they are. Having a program where you had to go to do a PhD just wasn't going to be an option for me. So I started looking for other options, how I could still be in the psychology field and still help people and get to learn how people work. And that's when I was like, okay, I could be a therapist. I was in school at the time. That's what I was interested in, but also loved doing research for podcasts. I think those 2 worlds colliding really taught me, like, oh, I really want to do this. When my podcast ended, the friends I had made along the way were starting to make money with ads. And so they asked if they could hire me to do the research, because people don't typically like to do that part of things. And I said, yes, absolutely. Then I graduated from college and kept doing research. 9 years later, here I am. So I never did become a therapist, but I still use some of those skills that I was wanting to use in therapy when I work with families. I did start 9 years ago, before ethical true crime was even a conversation, at least not one that anyone I knew was having. Back in the day, we did podcasts where we talked about serial killers, and there was no real thought process behind the victims. It really was like, why did this killer do this? What was their childhood like? It was so sensational. I was doing something wrong. And it's okay to admit that, to make it better. We're not perfect people. We all make mistakes in every aspect of our life. In 2019, one of my really close friends, Amanda, her grandparents were murdered in this very salacious and crazy way. And I remember when she told me about it, I thought, oh, this would be perfect for a podcast. And then I thought, how would Amanda feel if one of the podcasts I work for did a podcast about her family with no one talking to her? It was like this aha moment for me where I was like, whoa, should I be telling stories without the family having any part of it? That was pretty early on in my career, and no one at that point was really talking about getting family permission. That was my first true lifting of the veil. I still remember having that question pop up in my mind. And now that I look back on it all these years later, I'm like, why the hell was that the first time I questioned that? But a lot of times, things don't become important to us or become something that we pay attention to until it directly affects us. I started questioning ethics, and I would talk to my mentor about it all the time. But again, I am just working for other people at this point. I'm not that far into my career. So I just kind of hid those feelings in a box and just kept on with my career. At one point, I did try to leave, and at a particularly low point, I did interview for another job. When I was going to college and when I first started podcasting, I was working for the state. I didn't particularly love it, but it was just like, well, I'll just go back to that. It was the first job interview I'd ever been to where I didn't get the job. And then right after that, a bunch of opportunities came my way. My Favorite Murder reached out to me and asked me to work for them. I knew that there had been accusations of them not doing the best research. And I thought, I can bring my research expertise to this and can really help the show become less sensationalized. They make these real life cases seem even crazier than they actually are, even though you don't need to do that because murder in general is in itself sensational. I thought, if I provide these podcasts with this actual research that is based in good sources and is a full encompassing of the story, then I would be helping the community. I worked for My Favorite Murder. At the same time, they asked me to work for Murder Squad, which was a podcast that focused on unsolved cases only. And that was another big pivot point in my career. Before that, I didn't think I was making a difference. I was just researching, which is what I love to do. When I got the job offer to work for Murder Squad, I was like, I can use my expertise for good. I really loved learning about these unsolved cases. I didn't ever work with the families directly. The producer did that. But it was really interesting to me because I was like, I can find all this information. I can help put this story together and this family can get coverage. So it was something that I fell in love with doing. And then that show came to an end and I lost my position there. I really wanted to continue working on cold cases because I felt like I was making a difference. I was having one of those times where I was like, what am I doing with my career? I was finally helping people. Now that's gone away. So I went to the podcast I work for and I just said, I really want to cover unsolved cases. And at that time, all of the podcasts that I work for, they were like, well, we've never covered unsolved before. We don't have the expertise for that. So I said, I have the expertise when it comes to researching these things. And then this is the last pivot moment. And this is the one that really changed my entire life. I get goosebumps every time I tell this story. The only podcast that I worked for who ended up saying yes to covering unsolved cases was Moms and Murder.
One of the most recurrent themes of my mental health journey in the wake of my mom's murder, my divorce, and the rest of my adult struggles is that talking it out is key. and I am a huge proponent of talk therapy with a safe, trusted therapist. But I am the first person to acknowledge the difficulty of finding a therapist, especially one that's affordable and/or takes your insurance. Most online therapy platforms fall short. Many don't work with insurance at all, which means you're stuck paying the full cost out of pocket or paying for an expensive monthly subscription. Rula does things differently. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 per session. That's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. Rula isn't just affordable. The experience is tailored around you. Other online therapy platforms might match you with the first available provider, whether or not they're a good fit. Rula considers your goals, preferences, and background to provide you a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who are actually aligned with what you need, because they know that finding the right therapist can make all the difference. No wait lists, no frustrating back and forth. Rula makes it easy to find a mental health provider who's accepting new patients, and appointments are available as soon as tomorrow. Plus, Rula sticks with you throughout your journey, checking in to make sure your care is helping you move forward. Go to rula.com/WCN to get started today. That's rula.com/WCN for quality therapy that's covered by insurance. Thank you again to Rula for sponsoring this episode.
Moms and Murder. They're now Moms and Mysteries. We actually changed the name after we started working with families because we realized that the name could be potentially offensive to families. We wanted to be able to approach people and not have them immediately be uncomfortable. They said, our first case that we do that's unsolved and where we work with families, can it be this case? We've been getting messages from this man's wife asking us to cover her husband's unsolved murder. They sent me a link to it. And so at the same time that that happened, I opened up my DMs. I saw I had a request, and it was from that woman. She had reached out to me and said, I can't get anyone to cover this story. Would you try to cover it on any of the podcasts that you work for? So it was like kismet. And this is Kirsten Breitigan, Jared Breitigan's wife. He had been murdered 6 months prior, and it had not been solved at the time. She was actually a Moms and Murder listener. Jared would hear her listening to it and would always laugh at the fact that she liked true crime. And then her own husband was murdered, and she was looking for coverage. We met with her, and it was the most life-changing experience working with her one-on-one. I met with her in September of 2022. And that Thanksgiving was the first major holiday that Kirsten would have without Jared. I remember being completely depressed the entire day because all I could think about was that Kirsten was having to do this Thanksgiving all on her own. I just was overcome with emotion over the thought of every single case I've ever covered. This is what those families are going through. And I was witnessing that for the first time up close and personal. And it was a huge slap in the face, like a giant burst of reality that I desperately needed, but hadn't been expecting. It was just a really sobering moment. And I didn't expect to get choked up talking about this, but it's just really those emotions when you start speaking with families and you know that every single moment of their life, they are missing their loved one. Every single holiday, there's that empty table and it forever changes them. That is what changes you and makes you realize I should probably stop talking about the perpetrator so much. Ever since then, every single holiday, I make a post on social media just reminding people you may be having a beautiful day, but please remember that there are other people where this day isn't so happy. I don't want to be a bummer, but I also want people to remember that this is reality because we can never forget that. Within a couple months of us working together, Jared's case was solved. I will never forget seeing her at the press conference crying on national TV. It makes me speechless now, but I remember thinking, this is her entire life. when those cameras turn off, she is still a grieving widow who lost the love of her life and is now raising a baby and then a toddler whose dad was murdered in front of her. This does not end for her. Her life is forever shattered. That was so impactful for me. Kirsten has taught me so much about grief. She's very open on social media, and she's talked about how the first year after Jared dies, she actually doesn't really remember anything. And that is traumatic to her because she had a 7-month-old baby and a 2.5-year-old daughter. And that year-long period of them growing, those are some of the most cherished memories that people have. And she doesn't have those because the grief stole those from her. Along the way, Kirsten told me a lot. The way that I handled things was different than anything she'd dealt with. I took the time to do things that she hadn't experienced in her advocacy journey. She just told me that I was special and that this is what I needed to be doing. She ended up starting a foundation, the Bright Again Foundation, and she asked the hosts of Moms of Mysteries and me to be on the foundation. She's been such a huge inspiration to me. She really helped me learn how to work directly with families in ways that aren't harmful. She would even let me come to her and be like, hey, I'm starting to work with this new family. I was thinking I was going to do this. She was just so incredibly patient, even though she was dealing with this traumatic, horrible situation and then also raising 2 very, very young children. So it really set me on this path of this is what I should be doing. That was almost 3 years ago. And ever since then, I just thought I can never not work with families. It's so important that people remember that this is the reality of true crime. It's not some sensational, juicy trial where all this crazy stuff happened. And can you believe that the killer did this? The reality of true crime is what happens when the cameras aren't on and the podcast ends and that person has to live their life without their loved one. And then as the years passed, true crime grew. I feel like we have changed to become more victim-centered and to learn about the victims and really highlighting their stories instead of the perpetrators. At least for me and the shows that I work for, I have, in some cases, been a part of that evolution, like coming to the shows that I've worked for a long time and said things like, I actually don't want to do things like this anymore. I think it's harmful. And I think we need to switch things up and work with families and things like that. Everyone I work for now is open to that. If they weren't open to that, then I don't work for them anymore. A lot of what I do, it's not getting the cases solved. That's never my goal when I set out to help families, because then I would never reach my goal. I also think families know that I'm not going to solve a case for them. That's the police. That's their job. A lot of what I do is more behind the scenes, helping families get media attention. And that can end up being what puts pressure on the police to do the right thing. Sometimes I just help them with actual advocacy efforts, coming up with game plans on what they can do, what they haven't done yet to get more attention. For example, a family that I work with in Dallas, the family of Armani Morgan, he went missing in early June of 2017 and he was found deceased the following month. Armani's aunt Robin has been his advocate and she reached out to me earlier this year. I worked with Robin on trying to get a donated billboard in Dallas, because that's something that you can do. A lot of billboard companies will donate space to families who need awareness on their loved one's case. So we were able to get a donated billboard in Dallas at a very important spot where 2 major highways intersect. And it was a huge deal that we got this. From that point, I worked with Detective Aaron Benzik from Solve the Case, and we were able to get multiple news articles written about the billboard and about Armani's case being unsolved. The biggest news outlet in Dallas covered the case, and then 2 others covered it as well. That plus everyone seeing the billboard led to the Dallas Police Department asking Robin and Armani's mom to come in for a sit down with the police for the first time in 8 years. That is huge for this family. Absolutely massive. They've never seen the police files. So for them to invite the family in to sit down and let them go through the files and let them ask questions is a massive win for the family. So that reinvigorates you and it makes you want to keep going. One of those people that I work with is Bruce Bieber. I met with Bruce last fall. I was looking for stories that involved domestic violence. I wanted to highlight a month's worth of domestic violence stories and share resources and statistics. I was also doing a bag drive to give back to domestic violence shelters. I was working with Nicole Schmidt, who is Gabby Petito's mom, and I was asking her if she had anybody in mind that I should work with, and she told me about Bruce. We met, and when I was talking to him, I knew that he was special. He has this way about him. I know everyone listening who listened to his episode knows what I mean. I knew that I wanted to help him in any way that I could. So instead of working on a podcast together, he told me he's very passionate about not only sharing his daughter Abby's story, but also working to change things so that officer-involved domestic violence is more known and talked about. And he wants to train police departments on OIDV and all these things. And I was like, how can I help Bruce with this mission? He would tell me what he's wanting to do. And then I would tell him if I had any advice on it, or if I didn't, I would look into it or find someone who could help him. I know that he's going to change the world more than he already has. By next year, we're going to see him at all these conferences speaking. I just really hate that he's not spending his retirement at the beach with Abby and her dog. And that's tragic. But people who are able to turn tragedy into change are just so incredibly strong and inspiring. I started working with families in 2022. At the end of 2023, I was thinking, there's more that families need from me. They don't just need me to help share their story on a podcast. Yes, that's very helpful, but there's so much more that they need. I had been paying attention to this advocacy group called Light the Way. I was so fascinated with what they were doing and how helpful they were with families. So I reached out to them. We started working together and teaching each other things. So I helped them understand more about the media, and then they helped me learn more about actual hands-on advocacy. It's been an incredible partnership. As 2024 was going on and I was helping more and more families, I never called myself an advocate. I was working hands-on with families to help share their story. So I do feel like that is advocacy. But I didn't want to call myself an advocate until I had the actual training. My friend Ryan Backman, who runs Project Cold Case, he's become a mentor to me, and he is on the board for the National Organization for Victim Advocacy, which is NOVA. He invited me to be on a panel with him for NOVA, which was a huge career highlight for me. I was like, I have made it. It was so exciting. He told me about how NOVA has a training course where you can become a credentialed advocate. It's a 40-hour curriculum. Half of it is in pre-recorded videos that you watch on your own. And then the other half, you do 5 days of 2 2-hour classes, 1 day a week for 5 weeks. You'll meet a lot of other advocates in the course. Some people are just renewing their credentials. So it's a great networking opportunity as well. Every time they do the course, I try to put together groups so that people can get the group rate. So if you want to follow me at Haley Gray Research on Instagram, I post about when the course is open. The credentialing process comes after the course. You have to pay extra to become part of the NACP. That's where you get your credentials. You have to prove that you did the hours, things like that. On top of that, you get credentials at the end of your name, which is kind of fun. There's different levels of credentialing for victim advocates. To move on to the next one, you have to have a certain amount of hours in advocacy. I will never meet those hours because I don't work for an organization. I just work for myself. So it's kind of more for people who work in the court system and who are working with survivors of a crime who are going through the court system. It's still incredibly helpful for other things. Like they talk about different ways to interact with people, different ways to handle trauma, different ways to handle your own thoughts as you're going. Working directly with survivors is heavy and you can have burnout. They call it empathy fatigue. I'm not sure how much of it actually transfers over into this very niche community that we have, but it was incredible. And I took a class from Spark, which is all about stalking awareness. That's where I learned about Debbie Riddle and her sister Peggy Klinke's story. Her story is the basis for National Stalking Awareness Month. And that was so eye-opening to me because as a true crime content producer, I realized that I was identifying domestic violence in my episodes and I would educate on domestic violence, but I wasn't educating people on stalking. I learned a lot during the course, and it's very broad, the amount of things that you learn. Being able to call myself a credentialed advocate, it's easier now for me to kind of get my foot in the door with people. They take me more seriously. Also, being able to work with the police more, that's been really helpful because sometimes police departments are apprehensive to work with podcasters, and I totally understand why. So it's just been completely career-changing and life-changing for me. I feel like being an advocate is what I'm meant to do.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I've taken all of the knowledge that I learned and I put together, it's called the Advocacy Blueprint. It's a free resource for families and advocates. It basically lays out what families need to know as they're going through this journey. The first part of it is breaking down the criminal justice system and what that looks like. I partnered with a prosecutor friend of mine who, in a gentle way, explained how the process is different than people think it is. The prosecutors are not working for the family. They're working for the state. There's some hard lessons in there, but some lessons that are very helpful to families to learn up front so that they have a better understanding of how things work.
What legislative or criminal justice related changes would you make in the systems to better support victims?
Oh man, there's so many of them. But the main one that comes to mind would just be to allow families to have access to the investigation files. There's one case, Lonnie Rogers, her daughter Allison actually has a petition out there for legislation called Lonnie's Law, where families should be able to look at investigative files after 20 years. And this comes from the fact that her mom's been missing for 44 years and she's never been able to see any of the police files. Put yourself in those shoes and imagine searching for your mom for 44 years. Her mom went missing when she was 5 years old. There's no way that Allison could be involved in her mom's disappearance. So why not let her look at the files? She makes a good point, which is she's done her own investigation over all these years. She's written a book about her mom's case, all these things. She's interviewed all these people. Why not let her look at the files and see if there's anything missing that she knows of? She could help the police. Why aren't the police departments working more hand in hand with these families? At the end of the day, the only people that can help you are the police and the DA's office or the prosecutor. I have met really great detectives who have worked with families and done everything that they can. So I know it's possible. Whenever I do meet a good detective, I am huge on validating people because we all need that. And it can be reinvigorating and motivating to know that we are on the right path. This job, it's not exhausting, at least for me, to work with families one-on-one. That actually can be re-energizing for me to speak to a family and get excited about this is how I'm going to help them. What is exhausting and what makes me sometimes lose hope is how horrible families can be treated. I stop and think, well, that's why I have to keep talking about this stuff and sharing these things, because that's the only way we're going to get people to change. In the last 9 years, so much has changed. I do believe that victims and survivors coming forward to speak about how harmful true crime is what has changed this genre. I still think that the people who listen to sensational true crime and consume that type of media, it's just that they haven't had the experience yet to change them. If I had never spoken to a victim's family or to a survivor, I maybe would have never changed, because hearing what true crime looks like to them through their lens makes you want to change. And the more people who talk about ethical true crime and what that looks like, the more people who are going to pay attention. That's exactly how I found out what I was doing was wrong. As ethics has become a conversation, I've chosen to listen and to learn from that. I have tried to become a voice to get others to change as well, because not everyone has the opportunity to hear directly from victims and survivors. This podcast is great for that. As a listener, I think people can make a difference. If people stop listening, then the podcast is going to see a dip in numbers and they're going to think, well, what am I doing wrong? And they're going to have to evaluate what's going on.
Any words of encouragement or advice for victims' families or victims who have had to advocate for themselves?
First of all, keep going. Don't give up. Don't let the system get you down. There are always other avenues that you can take to try and get awareness out there about your loved one's story or your own story. The other thing that I love to talk to families about is don't ever be afraid to just reach out to someone if you feel like they could help you with what you're doing. Reaching out to victims' advocate services if you're not getting anywhere else and ask for help. There are always people that you can reach out to. And if they can't help you, maybe they can send you to someone who can. If you're floundering, maybe take a moment, take a day off, regroup, and then come back and see, okay, what are the other avenues that I can do to maneuver around this roadblock? If you're interested in advocacy, there's a free advocacy program at True Crime Research Training. It's geared towards families who are going through their advocacy journey, but it's also for advocates, and you can learn different ways to help families, like the billboards. I love to do this thing where you make coffee sleeves with information about a missing or murdered person, and then you take it to local coffee shops and see if they'll use the sleeves. There's a bunch of information in there on different ways to share stories. And there's a lot of ways that people can help families, advocates, friends, family. There's multiple avenues that you can take. If you want to be a researcher, I have a training course called True Crime Research Training, where you can learn how to research true crime cases ethically, like I do. And you can find information about that at truecrimeresearchtraining.com. When it comes to research, it's really important to make sure that you do a deep dive search and find credible sources. Those are really important. Don't just get your research off of Wikipedia. Find multiple sources to verify your information. You also just have to question sources in general. If you are reading an article and it sounds like a tabloid or sounds sensational, then that's a problem. Because when the media, like an NBC affiliate, covers a case, they don't make it sound sensational. They're just laying the details out there. My favorite way to research is newspapers.com. I use it constantly. They have all these archives of newspapers going back to the 1800s from all over the United States. And there's also other countries like Canada and United Kingdom. And you can find so much information in these old newspaper archives. That has always helped me put together a really comprehensive document on what happened, how a case unfolded. It can be really interesting if you're working on a cold case. I think most people would be astounded by the level of information you can find in newspaper archives as opposed to just going to Google. One thing that I do when I work with families is I will download the clippings that I find and send them to them, because some of those families, maybe they're a sibling who is now working on the case, and maybe their parents were the ones who did it for a long time and they've passed away and now the siblings have taken over. They maybe have never seen these articles before. Or maybe what if somebody spoke to the newspaper, but the police didn't know about that person, and so now they have a new person to go speak to. There's so many great things about these archives that are so helpful. I also love court documents, but of course you don't get those with every case. If a case is unsolved, then you usually don't have any type of court documents, but those would be my ultimate source because you're going to get the most amount of information from those. Every state has their own version of FOIA. New York is FOIL, Freedom of Information Law. Florida is the Sunshine Law. There's also Colorado Open Records Act. FOIA is technically federal. I have free trainings out there for people if you're interested in learning how to file a FOIA request. We just use that as a broad term, but every state is different and you have to figure out their statutes. We always recommend families still put in a records request, even if they feel like it might be denied, just because even a denial can give you information. The only issue is sometimes they're expensive. What I've seen cost the most money is that they have to pay staff members to redact things. So it's not just as easy as them being like, here are the files, that should be free. But for example, I just submitted a FOIA request for a case from the 80s in Texas. The actual files, it's like 10 cents a page, but they had to pay somebody for like 10 hours to redact all of the files. So that's where it's really coming in, is the cost of redaction. But then I've also worked with some counties that just send me the stuff for free. So when you file a request, I actually have a template that my friend who's a FOIA expert put together. In the template, you should put on there if you have a maximum amount of money that you're wanting to spend on a FOIA. So if it ends up being more than that, then they have to contact you. And then I recommend you ask them to send you an invoice of what all of the items are and how much they cost. And then you can determine what you want. For example, with this family that I'm working with, they're looking for a very specific point in the body cam footage. So I just told them, ask for an itemized list of what all they're trying to send you. And let's try to figure out which one of those videos includes the information that you're trying to find. And then that way we can lower the cost and just request that file. So there's definitely different ways to go about it. And it's one of the best tools that you can have. I really love sharing what I do on my Instagram and also on LinkedIn. I want everyone to have this knowledge so that we can all make this space a better place for families. Again, we're all learning as we go. I'm still learning how to be the best advocate I can be. I don't have all the answers, but I'm trying.
I so appreciate you. Thank you so much for all of this. You have such a perspective of so many fields.
This has been a great conversation. I really appreciate you giving me a platform to talk about all of this, because I really do want to help people as much as possible and get this information out there.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Thank you again to Rula for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to head to rula.com/WCN
to get started today. That's RULA.com/WCN for quality therapy that's covered by insurance.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.